Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with Joan Walsh, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine, about her latest book, co-authored with Nick Hanauer and Donald Cohen, Corporate, I'm going to say BS. If you look up the book or pick it up, you will see B-U-L-L-S-H asterisk T. We'll refer to it for the course of this as Corporate BS. Exposing the lies and half-truths that protect profit, power, and wealth in America. And to learn more about the book, but more really about Joan, go to The Nation, one word, thenation.com, and search for Joan Walsh. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, health, science, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, all one word, TerrenceMcNally.net. Let me share with you a brief version of my take on the economic and political history that has led to our current predicament in terms of inequality and endangered democracy, one that regular listeners to this show know all too well. When folks wear hats proclaiming their desire to make America great again, I assume they mean America from the end of World War II through the early 1970s. These were not the best of times for people of color, women, or the environment. Employment was solid and reliable. Wealth was shared. The U.S. was leader of the world in many categories. And at the core of all of it was the greatest middle class the world had ever seen. Though that may be a time MAGA folk look back on fondly, taxes were high, really high at times. Unions were strong, and through the ongoing tussle between industry, labor, and government came success and growth. And rooted in 1960s idealism, we were out to share the prosperity even more. Richard Nixon signed into law both the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Two things happened in 1970 that I believe set us on a course that I and today's guest hope we can change. Milton Friedman, in a New York Times op-ed, declared that the sole purpose of corporate behavior was to enhance shareholder value. And attorney and soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell wrote a highly influential memo advocating that business redefine its relationship to politics and government. Don't let anybody tell you that ideas don't matter. Both of these were just ideas, but they were adopted with a vengeance, ultimately laying waste to shared prosperity. And with things like Citizens United, our politics have steadily become more and more instruments of that destructive strategy. The market, unfettered, or more accurately, especially since Citizens United, writing its own rules, cannot respond effectively to the most critical challenges we face. Crises that have either grown out of the distortion of our economy and our politics, or are unsolvable because of them. Inequality, climate change, an unhealthy relationship with the rest of nature, pandemics and public health, social and racial division and tribalism, crippled government, and endangered democracy. We need to imagine a winning system that can. Steve Bannon has been very clear for years, people will rise up. A populist revolution is coming. This is Bannon's words. Will it be an uprising of the left or the right? I've been returning to this whole situation a lot on the show recently. And let me just note two conversations in particular, which you can find on my website or at those other podcast sites. One was with Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway on their book, The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. And the other is Gary Gerstel, G-E-R-S-T-L-E, on his book, The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order. And I recommend both. Today's guest and her co-authors add another valuable piece to the puzzle of what's gone wrong, why, how, and what we can do about it. They dig into the myths and the strategies of the right, and they focus on specific tactics, in particular on six big lies used over and over again to hold on to power and hold back progress. As they make clear, from the movement to abolish slavery to the campaign to end child labor, from the progressive era push for a fairer tax system to the decades-long quest to create and strengthen the social safety net, from efforts to protect lives from dangerous cars and chemicals to today's struggle to curb climate change, much of our history, I'm quoting the description of their book that they put out, much of our history has been a battle between ordinary Americans mobilizing to build a safer, fairer, stronger country, and political and corporate elites resisting reform in order to preserve a status quo that serves their interests. And time and again, they've trotted out the same lies, a little nuance here, a little nuance there, but basically the same lies to do this over and over again. Joan Walsh, a national affairs correspondent for The Nation, was previously editor-in-chief of Salon, salon.com, and an on-air political analyst at CNN and MSNBC. She's a co-producer of The Sit-In, Harry Belafonte Hosts the Tonight Show, and author of What's the Matter with White People Finding Our Way in the Next America? Her latest book, co-authored, as I said, with Nick Hanauer and Donald Cohen, is Corporate BS, Exposing the Lies and Half-Truths That Protect Profit, Power, and Wealth in America. Welcome, Joan Walsh, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Thursday, November 30th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us in your words a bit about how you see your path to the work you do and the life you lead? Feel free to go way back, childhood inspirations, mentors, turning points, that sort of thing.
Well, sure. You know, I often say, and I say this in my last book, What's the Matter with White People? I am very much a child of Irish Catholics, Irish Catholic, granddaughter of Irish Catholic immigrants from Cork.
We share this, by the way.
Is Cork or
well,
Ireland?
Cork. Actually,
Cork?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. But one generation earlier in my family, but Irish Catholic originally from Cork.
Well, that's a whole interesting conversation because there's two versions of our family story. And the one that I grew up with, thanks to my father and my mother, was that the Irish Catholics came here. We faced discrimination. We overcame it for the most part. And it was our job to help other people overcome it. And so as a child, the central drama in our society and the questions of good and evil, frankly, had to do with the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And I was raised to literally believe that it was our job to bring down the various barriers to full participation for Black people and other people of color, partly because we had faced not the same by any means, but we had faced our own discrimination. There was a time when we were not considered white.
That's right.
There was a time people didn't want us to vote. And so I think that really sort of created this foundation for me to really care about social justice. Now, we know some of our fellow, children of Irish Catholic immigrants went in a different direction. thank God he's gone, but people like Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity is still with us.
Coughlin, isn't Coughlin Irish?
I believe Father
Reverend
Coughlin right.
Back in the mid-20th.
Right. Went in a very conservative direction, and some of that had to do, a lot of it had to do with the church and church teachings and the fear of communism being a particularly godless government organization of government, and a lot of other really, kind of petty, scared things too. But at any rate, my upbringing led to, the Catholic social teachings, Catholic social justice mission, And I never wavered. I'm only an occasionally practicing Catholic. I'm mostly out of practice, but I still go to church sometimes. But I feel very culturally Catholic, and I feel that in the way that I was taught to understand the teachings. And so I think that that really started my lifelong concern with these issues.
It's interesting because I hadn't really expected that. I know when I looked and I saw Joan Maureen Walsh, I thought she could have sat behind me in grade school.
That's
Although
right.
in high school she'd have been in a separate high school because the Catholic
All
high school
right.
separated the boys and girls. But okay, so that set the early pattern, and now I'll jump ahead a bit here and talk more about your career. You've been an editor at Salon, both a news editor and then the editor in chief, writer, columnist, commentator. As I said, on CNN and MSNBC, and author. And I may have left out some roles along the way, but
Mother, dog
sure.
owner,
Okay. But can you share a bit about your experience in these different roles in media and maybe how the challenges are different and the impact is different, the satisfaction might be different?
Sure. I mean, I have been a journalist for, liberal to progressive to even socialist publications from the very beginning. I worked for my campus. I went to the University of Wisconsin. And I was a writer and an editor for the Daily Cardinal, which is one of the nation's oldest campus dailies, which was very, I was there after really the anti-war movement. The war was over.
And just for
But
people who don't know, the Wisconsin was a big player in the anti-war movement, and certainly the anti-war movement on college campuses.
yes, it was. There was a lot of activism, a lot of division. It is where there was a very unfortunate and awful bombing in 1970 that killed a graduate student. And those divisions were kind of still present on campus when I got there in 1977, which is in some ways unbelievable, maybe, but maybe not. But it was a very, very radical paper. I went on to work for a community newspaper that was actually a collective at the time in Santa Barbara, California, that had been founded by radical people. So my whole career, I've certainly written for mainstream papers and magazines as a contributor, but my jobs have all been with newspapers and magazines that are very progressive, and I've been lucky that way. But as we both know, Salon was the next big thing when it got off the ground almost 30 years ago.
Yes, we had a little conversation off air. I know you got there in 98, but as you pointed out, which would have been 25 years, but as you pointed out, it's been around since 95. One thing about Salon, where you were editor in chief, is much broader than politics. I looked even today, lifestyle, celebrities, health, science. So that was a bit of a broader reach, but before and after, your focus has been more in politics, yes?
Yes, I mean, what I loved about Salon was our founder David Talbot called it a smart tabloid, and always was very proud of our cultural coverage and our movie critics and our TV critics as our politics writers. Although I started out as a news editor and writer, and also wound up there, when I was editor in chief, we had, we had great culture coverage too, and I think that that was important to our success, and continues to be. At The Nation, I have the great fortune to be able to write about the TV show Succession, as well as cover the real Succession drama with Rupert Murdoch and the Fox nightmare. So I think that combination of culture and politics is very vital and very, very vibrant. But we really thought we were remaking things, and that the web was going to change all of the dynamics of publishing, and it did, but in some ways not in a good way. And the kind of advertising returns that supported newspapers for so many years, the web laid waste to it. We didn't get the kind of advertising dollars, but the newspapers lost the dollars. And so what we wound up with is a somewhat shrunken media landscape. Before I got on with you, I saw that there are layoffs today at Condé Nast, at Vanity Fair, at Vox Media. And so we continue to struggle to find business models that will support groundbreaking investigative journalism, and not just investigative, but, you know, smart journalism
substantive.
That really
yeah.
substantive journalism, including opinion, with people who are incisive and insightful about history and about politics and about culture and the way they all intertwine. And
yeah.
so,
and one thing you actually left out of your little litany there, because you were looking at the national picture, is the more even more devastating decimation of local journalism.
Absolutely. I would agree with you that it's even more devastating, and really leading to very bad actors on the state and local level
yeah.
getting away with things
yep.
that would have been scandals 10, 20, 30 years ago. So it's a very tough environment. It's discouraging, but I've been able to keep at it and make a career out of
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah. As I was preparing, I thought, even before we delve into the book, let me ask you, and if this is just too ridiculous, we can edit it out. But when I saw that you started at Salon 25 years ago, and that you've been writing, commenting, authoring ever since, if you took a deep breath and looked back beyond what you were just saying about the challenges of media, how do you look at the last 25 years in terms of how the country, the politics, the society, the media have changed? When you're maybe at a Thanksgiving dinner and you're kind of sitting back and people are waxing a little nostalgic or a little desperate?
Well, yeah, I would have to go back a little farther. I would like to, well, that's not true. I'm very proud of my whole career, but I got out of college in 1980 and I went straight to work in Santa Barbara for the paper I referenced earlier, the Santa Barbara News and Review. And you and our listeners may recall, Santa Barbara was the Western White House for Ronald Reagan.
That's right.
And so I was really starting out my career at a very dispiriting time for progressives, for liberals, for Democrats, for people who believed in equality, believed in, as you said earlier, the market needed to be regulated and not rigged on behalf of the rich, but regulated for everybody's benefit, which it had been. I was a child of that great expansion that you discussed,
yeah.
the post-war expansion of opportunity, the creation of the middle class. I think I paid, or my dad paid, $350 a semester to go to the UW-Madison, which was one of the best schools in the country.
Absolutely.
And still is. There were just a lot of things provided to me that were later withdrawn from later generations. And it was as though the scaffolding of opportunity that had let my family, my Irish Catholic immigrant family, and on the other side, they were also Irish Catholic immigrants, mostly, but like yours, a generation or even two earlier, that had let them rise as well. And so, to start your career as Ronald Reagan is, riding horses with Nancy at the Western White House and holding press conferences down the street from your office, it was really quite the awakening. And so I think that the story that you started out by telling, which does start in some ways in 1970, we can date it, at various points, obviously. But it really comes to fruition, I would argue, in the Reagan administration.
Oh, absolutely.
Where all of those ideas about the free market can save us. We fought a war, as Reagan said, and we write about this at length in the book, Maybe the most dangerous story ever told was Ronald Reagan saying the federal government fought a war on poverty and poverty won. It wasn't true, but it also gave people who maybe, you know, weren't racist and thought of themselves as concerned about poverty, it let them say, oh, I care about poverty, but government programs make poverty worse. And therefore, I support cutting taxes, letting the free market take over, cutting welfare, sending poor mothers into the labor force without, you know, let's not worry about what to do with their kids, et cetera. So I was a witness from, you know, the first days of my adult career to the dismantling of all these opportunities that we wind up writing about at great length in this book.
And although that's a quote from Reagan, as I was reflecting on the six lies, which we will talk about, it seemed that Reagan had versions kind of all of them.
Yes.
And well learned, as people may know or may not, he had been a progressive president of the Screen Actors Guild. He was a union president. And through his time with GE, General Electric, when he hosted their television show, but even more than that, went around the country making speeches and presentations, he was willingly, I assume, but he was transformed from that progressive sort of middle-of-the-road centrist kind of person and philosophy he held to one where he became the ideal spokesman for these lies and the program of government is the problem.
Right. And we could have had a whole chapter on Reagan. I feel you're right. I think he's in every chapter, but he's really emblematic, partly because, yes, he evolves from semi-progressive, although we've got to say that, you know, Dwight Eisenhower was more a Republican president before JFK, was perhaps more progressive than certain Democratic presidents. There was that consensus in the 50s and 60s that labor had a role to play, that unions had a role to play, and that, you know, we could all work together to build the society. Reagan was part of that, and then he gets, I'm not sure exactly how to describe it, but gets co-opted, convinced,
paid off,
perhaps.
His career prior to that GE gig was fading, and
right,
he became one of the most recognizable people in America. I mean, you almost couldn't look for a better platform to later run for governor or president than he had.
Absolutely, and they really cultivated him that way. He was fading. He was getting fewer movie parts. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't want to go on and do Bedtime for Bonzo 3 or something.
Right.
You know, so he was remade. He remade himself and became a very slick pitchman for the free market. You know, he crusaded against Medicare and the passage of Medicare, which was a long time coming, but he was hired by the AMA to create, it was a record, I believe, not even a TV ad, but an old phonograph record. Preaching about the evils of Medicare and how it represented socialism. And if we pass this bill, you know, my fellow Americans, we will be telling our children about the old days of freedom now that we live in, you know, in this shadow of socialism, mm-hmm. Et cetera, very dramatic, very overwrought. And then after that, not so much as a pitchman for capitalism, but as kind of his own freelance version of politics and, you know, right-wing California politics, he really went to the right and became very, pugilistic and I would argue racist, quite honestly, in terms of the way he talked about welfare, you know, the Cadillac driving welfare queen and the young buck eating T-bone steaks with his food stamps, and those long-haired hippie rioters, and let's teach them a lesson. a lot of, again, MAGA stuff.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. And I think one thing that you alluded to but didn't quite say is why he is such an embodiment of what your book is about is that he could lie so pleasantly. So
pleasantly.
That he was, in some sense, you know, the ideal pitchman for these lies because he just seemed so, at least to many, I never bought it, but neither did you, you know, being a few blocks down the road. But that he was, of course he meant well. You know, of course he was looking out for us. He was Grandpa. He was Uncle Ron.
Right. He had those twinkly eyes and that, you know, adorable smile. But also I think he, you know, the transformation from, you know, snarling welfare queens and, you know, young bucks and all that kind of language to, you know, we fought a war on poverty and poverty won, you know. We care about you all, but you know, we don't want to hurt you anymore. The Democrats want to hurt you.
Right.
And we want to help you. That was really, really, you know, perhaps his biggest shift and a really canny shift because it really sold the dismantling of, you know, not just the welfare state, but unionism, of all the things that we discussed that created a great middle class and also helped poor people climb into the middle class. We needed to just shut that whole thing down because, it turned out this is really hurting people. Unions hurt people. Union bosses are bad. They're worse than, you know, capitalist bosses. And so his various evolution from, you know, literally the 40s through the 50s, 60s through the 80s is a really interesting story of American capitalism, American democracy, lack of democracy, and American storytelling.
And American media, yeah. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, about her latest book, co-authored with Nick Hanauer and Donald Cohen, Corporate BS. They spell the word out with an asterisk where it's needed, exposing the lies and half-truths that protect profit, power, and wealth in America. And you can learn more by going to thenation.com, one word, thenation.com. Search for Joan Walsh. Let's switch to the book, Joan, and let me ask, how did it happen? Was there a moment you knew you had to write it? That was there the first itch you scratched, kind of? And then how did you connect with Nick and Donald?
Well, Nick and Donald had connected first, and they had each had kind of separate projects that were seeking to do similar things. I mean, Nick and his group Civic Ventures in Seattle had something called the Ridicule Project, which was really trying to show the nonsense behind so many corporate lies, basically, that we go on to talk about in the book. Don had over time created something called the Cry Wolf Project, which was in large measure about how corporations always tell you that the reform you want to bring about is going to just make things worse, and you know, will be the end of capitalism, will destroy jobs, will be the end of Los Angeles, et cetera, et cetera. And it never happens. It, you know, the boy who cried wolf. And so they got together and thought about, you know, this could be a book. This is a great project. And they brought me in. And, you know, Don especially had a gold mine of the quotes that we wound up using. I mean, we went in different directions and found new quotes. But he had a database of all the ways that corporations have sold their agenda in different guises over, you know, over the centuries, literally. And, you know, as we tried to dig into it and figure out what made the most sense in presenting it, we decided against going through it as, you know, here's a chapter on the lies about environmentalism or the lies about civil rights or the lies about unions.
That's right. So we're not going to do it issue by issue.
Right. But we have some case studies where things are particularly egregious and ridiculous. But we divided it into these six categories of lies, and they tell these lies about everything. And they, you know, and so whether it's, you know, defending slavery as being the Negroes of Central Africa, you know, are the most civilized and have benefited morally, psychologically, spiritually, and that's from John Calhoun, who was a vice president and a South Carolina senator and part of the push for the Civil War and a great defender of slavery, to Ron DeSantis in Florida saying, you've got to teach that slavery provided the enslaved with some benefits,
some,
you know,
benefits,
some skills.
Yes.
It just goes on and on. And so we thought it would be more entertaining and maybe more useful, and to get back to the notion of ridicule and humor, to show, you know, this is what they've always done, and this is what they keep doing.
Very, very good. So that's how you chose your approach. Let me ask you just a little bit. I've co-written a book, I've co-written scripts. Three authors is not that common. How did you work together?
We worked together. We worked with a great researcher, Zachary Roth. We had this database of quotes. We had meetings where we finally, not finally, it didn't, it wasn't hard, where we agreed on the six different categories and how to approach it, not to do issue by issue. And then, you know, I took a crack at basically writing the narrative, essentially. Mm. Nick wrote the preface, and I wrote the narrative. And then we would meet every 6 weeks or so to look, to read over drafts, to make decisions where there were decision points. And, you know, we were able to, I mean, I'm sure I'm forgetting things that were contentious, but.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's nice.
But I really am, or maybe they didn't happen, because for the most part, of course we disagreed about this or that, but.
Yeah.
For the most part, we agreed, and, you know, we reached consensus on everything. Everybody had to, you know, like every word,
sure,
and
sure.
Feel good about every word in the book. And so, you know, we worked with Nick's team at Civic Ventures. We had a lot of help from them. And it was an interesting but really great process.
Great. Can you very briefly, but just so people know a little more, because we've gone into Joan Walsh's past and career, just a little bit about, beside, you've mentioned their current projects or programs or organizations, but just a little bit about Nick and Donald's backgrounds. I think it's fascinating.
Yes. Well, you know, Nick Hanauer should need no introduction, but maybe he does. He is an entrepreneur, an investor, who made a fortune from Amazon and Microsoft, and a lot of early, speaking of the, you know, the tech revolution.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think he invested in Salon, which was probably a good idea for him, but, you know, made his fortune that way. But always, always had a commitment to social justice, and got exposed to these kinds of self-deluding corporate arguments that we're the ones who know best, we're doing the best for people, up close and personal, in a way that I certainly never did. Donald has worked, he founded a group called In the Public Interest. He's worked on a lot of public interest causes. He wrote a book a few years ago called The Privatization of Everything,
mm-hmm.
And has been a lobbyist, or I shouldn't say a lobbyist, but somebody who's advocated for social justice policies, and has seen over and over again, you know, going to LA County Board of Supervisor meetings and talking about the minimum wage or some kind of environmental regulation, and seeing the Chamber of Commerce guys come up time and again with, again, these same arguments. Mm-hmm. And so that's his background. And so the three of us had very different backgrounds, but had arrived in the same place.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and before we get into the six lies specifically, can you talk a bit about the larger system of justification and deceit, where they come from, how it gets around, how, you know, small fry and big fry have the same stories to tell. How did this evolve, and how does this strategy work sort of as an umbrella that then, you know, you're able to say, well, here's six lines that show up an awful lot.
Right. Well, I think Nick puts it really well in the preface, where he says, and I'm not reading from it, but basically I can paraphrase, they use pro-social language to cloak a genuinely anti-social agenda or set of goals. You know, going back to Reagan,
right.
We want to cut poverty programs, but we're going to say it's to help the poor. We are opposing the minimum wage, but that's because raising the minimum wage will cost jobs and, you know, hurt. This comes up over and over.
Hurt the people you're trying to help. Yes.
Exactly. Young Black teenagers, like, oh, young Black teenagers don't deserve to make a decent wage, you know, and things like that. And he saw it over and over. And I think that's the larger system in which these six mm-hmm. lies
and then,
operate.
Then it also seems to me, and you make this point, I believe, that the order even of which they're trotted out matters, that it's not just a random set of lies. They feed off each other, or they build on each other. If you don't like this one, I've got another one for you kind of thing. Can you talk just a bit about that?
Right. It's like the nesting doll of lies. You get rid of one and then there's another one inside.
Or the Terminator, I mean, right?
Right. But yeah, I mean, you know, if we're going to go through the six lies, I don't know that they always go in order. I mean, obviously they don't, because we see them throughout the years. But,
right.
you know, they start, but they say it's not a problem.
Right. I tell you what, you know, yeah, switch right now, Joan, to the six lies.
Okay.
Go for it.
Well, they start with it's not a problem. So you have West Virginia governor claiming that, you know, mining is not dangerous. It's just in the natural course of nature that, you know, that mining is difficult and accidents will happen. You have tobacco barons saying nicotine is not addictive. You have a DuPont chemical chair saying we don't pollute the water. Actually, we leave the water cleaner when we're done with it than it was before. You know, you have the lead industries, multiple, saying lead is not harmful. It's not harmful in the air. It's not harmful in
paint.
In paint, you even have a lobbyist say lead is good for you. We've all got a little in our bodies, and you know, more is better. So you know, it starts there. It's not a problem. And then when they're really forced to admit there's some kind of problem there, they say it's not our fault. It's your fault. And so you have a whole genre of corporate defenses where, you know, going back to coal mining, because so much of it has to do with coal mining and early manufacturing. Well, the problem isn't the coal mining industry or mining, you know, per se. It's that workers are not wearing the proper equipment, and you can't necessarily force a man to wear a helmet and, you know, the right shoes. That chemical poisoning on the job, it doesn't happen to everybody, but if you're a guy who maybe drinks too much alcohol, then you're going to have a problem. You know, we see even seat belts and everything from lowering the speed limit to all kinds of auto safety measures being poo-pooed as unnecessary, because the problem is literally, quote, the nut behind the wheel. And so, you know, and obviously maybe the most famous one is, you know, guns don't kill people. People kill people,
right,
from the gun lobby, where you can't do anything about this because the human being is the real problem.
It's a mental health issue.
It's a mental health issue, exactly. And so that, you know, that's That's a big one because I think there is also something, I don't know if it's particularly American, but we can be easily inclined to blame ourselves. And so I think they've got kind of a psychological thing going on there where, that it resonates with people. Oh yeah, we can still have coal in our communities. Or, more recently, the opioid issue. The Sackler family, the memos were uncovered saying the problem isn't the drugs, it's the addict, when we know that the manufacturers and their salespeople lied about how strong and addictive these medications were and peddled them ridiculously to make a profit.
And
So
let me just jump in on the Sackler thing for a second, because it wasn't just their in addition to their lies, they co-opted or corrupted the FDA to actually stand behind their lies, which I think is another piece of that worked them. But one other thing about that one is, as I'm thinking about that, is the opioid defense it turns out to be different than crack or heroin. You get what I'm saying? In other words, the when the drug was suddenly killing lots of white people,
Well, they're still blaming the victim. I think in all three,
but the
in all the cases, they're trying to blame the victim. I think that, we've seen a lot more sympathy from politicians, because the opioid, we say, crisis, mainly affects white people. So it's complicated,
Yeah,
but
I wasn't going to say it's a black and white, pardon the mixed metaphor there, but that the whole in other words, in the illegal drug market, the dealer was even a bigger villain than the addict.
Got it, got
In
it. I see what you're saying.
right, the dealer, the horrible, there's whole parts of town that are run by gang, all that stuff. And yet, when it's the opioids, the dealer's innocent. It's all the addict.
It's all the addict, exactly. No, that's a really good point, that we don't make in the book, but maybe in the sequel. I like that.
And then another thing that I think comes with the it's not your fault. I mean, it's your fault, not our fault. Is and I remember going to a panel. Actually, I've been in the entertainment industry, and there's a group in the entertainment industry that's associated with USC, I believe, that tries to put meaningful stories and lessons into scripts, right, for social good.
Yes.
And this panel was on food, diet, processed food, fat food, all the stuff that we know is creating the crisis of obesity, which is unlike anything else in history or the rest of the world in America.
Yes.
And the big push from what I learned there was that the big push, or I think there were even maybe people from the food industry there, but their thing was public education. Public education is the solution. People need free choice, but they just need more education. And then what you learn, if you dig a little, is that the percentage of money that they put into public education versus the percentage of money that they put into marketing the
Marketing.
dangerous stuff is it's not even a drop in the bucket.
Well, and it gets into, first they fought all kinds of food safety and food labeling standards. One of my favorite quotes in the whole book comes from a cattle bar lobbyist early in the 20th century opposing putting dates on meat packages and saying, why would you do that? When meat ages, it's just like whiskey,
Oh
it gets
no.
better. That's really a good one. You got to look that up. Okay, there's that. But then, so they fight labeling, and they fought a lot of labeling, all kinds of labeling, whether it was, on the package or, you know, in a restaurant. I remember just for some reason, my daughter used to love the Cheesecake Factory when she was younger, and we lived in California then, and California passed a law that every menu item had, and it's everywhere now, every menu item had to tell you how many calories it had. And some dish that we loved was like 1100 calories. It
Oh.
was like, oh, this is so painful. But okay, so these reforms take place. Some of them go along with it and say education, but then they get back into blaming the victim or the whatever, because it's like, you can't blame us for obesity. We've given you all this education and information. And therefore, if you're fat or obese or diabetic, it's your fault. You're choosing to eat this way when we all know that, you know, we've given you enough information that you know you shouldn't. Literally the same thing happens at a congressional hearing around cigarettes and tobacco, where they go from saying, oh, it's nicotine is not addictive, not
Right.
addictive, not
They
addictive,
first start with the, it's
to
not a problem.
it's not a problem. And then, well, everybody knows it's harmful.
Oh.
So if you're still smoking when we put the Surgeon General's warning on the packages, you're an idiot. You know, you can't sue us. You are choosing to do this dangerous thing. So we
I love it's not a transition. It is a radical shift from it's not harmful to everybody knows it's harmful.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's kind of, in some ways, that's my favorite
Yeah,
chapter.
because
And
we're innocent, whatever it may be. One thing I think comes up again and again, and we've even done it just in this conversation, is this freedom to choose.
yes.
That a lot of it seems to me, well, they may not say that in each case, it's the underlying foundation, sort of. And it is even, I mean, it was the original justification for child labor and is being used again today because
Bringing
I
back child labor,
let me
yeah.
just tell you that when I interviewed Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway a few months back about the big myth, which I, as I said, I feel is these are you know, almost companion books. One does
Yeah.
the big myth, and then you say, well, how do they do that? And then you go to your book and you go, well, they did it with this, you know, the specific one
Yeah.
is a big strategy, the other is tactics, right?
Yeah.
But that I happened to look at the headlines the day I interviewed them, and their book starts with, you know, how crazy is this myth? Well, they used to try to justify child labor, and it was the number one headline in the paper that day that they were at it
Right.
again 100 years later. But where I was going was this freedom, what's the word? It's almost like an idol, if you know what I mean.
Well, the idolatry of the free
Yeah.
market, freedom generally, which then becomes associated, which it doesn't have to be associated with, but again, this was done very craftily. Becomes associated with the free market.
Yes.
And so, you know, our third chapter is the free market can fix it.
Yep.
Okay, it's not a problem. Well, it is a problem, but it's your fault. Well, I don't know, maybe it's not your fault, but whatever it is, the free market left to its own devices will fix it. You know, the Chamber of Commerce lobbied against OSHA, you know, signed, as you noted, by Richard Nixon by
Right.
saying, we don't need this. Safety is good business. You know, Milton Friedman and Alan Greenspan argue that, you know, the capitalist, it's in his, they don't say his or her, that would just be me, very interest to put out good products. You have people saying, as late as Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, when he was running for Senate, said he supported a lot of civil rights laws, but he would not have voted for applying the civil rights bill to private accommodations like restaurants or, you know, movie theaters,
Hotels,
whatever,
yeah.
hotels, because he said, you know, if people chose to discriminate, they would go right out of business. And it was like, hello, Jim Crow, you know. Lester Maddox was, was defending his right to. He was a governor, but I believe he was a restaurant owner.
He was a restaurant owner, and so not only did his restaurant not go out of business, his stance got him elected governor.
Right, the restaurant thrives, and he gets elected governor. But it's his God-given free market right to discriminate against people. So it becomes a real fetish. Actually,
this freedom thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And I think, by the way, and we're seeing it now at the Supreme Court, where the freedom to be a religious bigot overrides the freedom of an individual to get the accommodations they want or the product they want or anything like that.
Right.
This is that same thing that it seems to me once you kind of say freedom, you can twist it that it will justify just about anything, which of course it brings us to Ayn Rand, right? A quote that you have, I believe, is private racism is not a legal issue, it's a moral issue. In other words, people should be able to decide who they want or don't want to associate with. That's how the market works. We decide what we want to buy or don't want to buy. You know, that
right.
She who is their icon actually right. said that. You know,
that she
there,
said
there should
it.
Be there no. should be no civil rights laws because
right.
that infringes on the freedom of people to discriminate.
Right. Yeah, it's very pervasive in all of that thinking, and people ascended to real positions of power. Mm-hmm. Like, not to pick on Alan Greenspan, but you have someone who was in charge of regulating money and markets who began as an Ayn Rand devotee.
Absolutely.
And a complete free market fetishist, and you
absolutist,
see
fundamentalist.
Fundamentalist.
Let's go. So we've done. There is no problem. Well, maybe there's a problem. If so, it's your fault. Okay, maybe the market will fix it, and then you have it's a job killer.
It's a job killer. That's a big one. Everything is a job killer. The New Deal was a job killer. After the Triangle Factory shirtwaist fire in 1911, that fire in which about 150 young immigrant women were killed, died in deadly ways. The doors to their sweatshop were locked. That fire, really triggered a lot of regulation and thinking about workplace safety and other protections that really did become the New Deal,
mm-hmm.
decades later, but mm-hmm. it originated there. But, it was going to make businesses flee New York. We were told, I'm not that old, but, so it goes back to that. It goes back to Social Security is going to kill jobs, unemployment insurance.
Nick's work on the $15 living wage campaigns.
Yes.
This was almost always the major argument against that one.
That's right. And in Seattle they were told, restaurants in particular were going to go out of business. And if you've been there recently, as I just was, there are quite a few restaurants. You have. There's very good food there.
Yes, yes. And one way that you guys actually characterize this is you say that this warning amounts to little more than a mafioso-like threat. Nice economy you have there. It'd be a shame if anything would have happened to it, right?
Exactly.
And then we've talked about the you'll only make things worse, and that's the government is the problem,
right?
And it's disempowers people to help them is basic, right? And there's all sorts
yes.
of ways that one. Let me just read a couple of quotes. This is Friedman in 1970, or in the 70s. The consequence of minimum wage laws have been almost wholly bad to increase unemployment and increase poverty. Thomas Dew in 1832. We cannot get rid of slavery without producing greater injury to both the masters and the slaves. We've talked about that one. So the last one is it's socialism.
It's all socialism. You know, it's all been socialism going back before the New Deal. But, you know, the rise of the Soviet Union really scared people, really scared capitalists. And suddenly, you know, so much of the New Deal, whether it was the Fair Labor Standards Act or Social Security, you're going down the road to socialism. We're going to lose all of our freedom. And it really was a word that scared people in this country. You know, I mean, it scared people in Europe too, but Europe actually had a more of a socialist tradition of actual socialist parties
and social democracies. Government. Yeah.
And social democracies. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, business leaders and conservative politicians, and even, you know, some Democrats really used the threat of socialism. Which again, you know, you'll lose your personal freedom, everything will be gray and grim, and, you know, everything will be worse than it was before. We've got these terrible systems that we can point to show you how this is. And, you know, we as we talked about before, Ronald Reagan says Medicare is the beginning of socialism.
Sure, sure.
The twilight of freedom.
And of course, the same thing when Obamacare, well, first of all, when Clinton's proposal for health care reform, it was met with the same response, and so was Obamacare. And still to this day, I think Trump says he, if elected in 24, he will try once again to get rid of Obamacare because it is socialism. Do you think, by the way, that the distance from the Cold War is something that makes young people much less nervous about socialism?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the Soviet Union hasn't existed in almost 40 years. You know, people did not grow up with that as quite the epithet. You've got the, you know, rise of Bernie Sanders and Democratic Socialists of America. We've seen polling that young people find it it's a relatively popular or at least not an unpopular term. You know, I would argue, and this is a little bit of a digression, you would probably agree with me, I would say that Bernie Sanders is not necessarily a socialist as in nationalize, take over the means of production, but more of a social democrat.
Exactly.
In, you know, regulation for the sake of social equality and equity. But whatever, that's kind of a language thing.
So
but I think.
I realize we've gotten very near the end of the hour, Joan, which has moved very swiftly. But
I know.
Some of the, you call the book a vaccine, some of the inoculation, some of the resistance. What do people do with this knowledge and this analysis?
I think they take it and they listen for it as they listen for these six lies, as they watch arguments spin out about social programs, social spending, you know, why we need to cut food stamps, et cetera. It's all still there. I think it helps people lobby better. I think it helps them organize better. I think we've seen one of the most encouraging things to me personally is the wave of union activism and the popularity of unions, whether it's Amazon workers or Starbucks baristas or the UAW or SAG-AFTRA and the Writers Guild. You know, I think there's a new spirit of we can't do this alone. We can do this together. And also a real sense that these owners are lying to us. And I think it's kind of a handbook that people can use to fight whether it's the backlash or the erosion of civil and social and economic rights all around the country.
Right. Yeah. One thing I will say is that we've certainly done it in our conversation. But although the book is called Corporate BS, we know that this extends beyond corporate BS. They're the designers, perhaps. But it's also certainly in the realm of politics.
Very much so in the realm of politics.
And it could have, but it just would have been a long and messier title. very good. So The book is Corporate B-U-L-L-S-H-T, Corporate BS. To learn more about Joan's work and the book, go to thenation.com and search for Joan Walsh. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or a world that just might work, all one word, a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually links to 10 or 15 articles, relevant, timely, fleshing out the conversation, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at TEMcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast at Apple Podcasts and most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts there. Naomi Klein, Michael Lewis, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNallyTerrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, Joan Walsh, keep up your good work.
Thanks, you too.